Here at the Datanauts Fortress of Facepalms, we're passionate about busting down silos and building IT that actually works. Because housing multiple tribes of disparate technology silos represented by SMEs who jealously guard their pile of data center hardware results in broken environments. In this show, we're going to cover a wide variety of topics with a technical professional who has shown a passion for going full stack across a number of skills. So, strap in, loyal listeners, as we tickle your noodle on certifications, mentoring, resources for learning, and much more. And welcome to another show of the Datanauts. I am Chris Wall, known as @ChrisWall on the Twitters, and joined again by the Sultan of Spanning Tree, Ethan Banks. Say hello, Ethan.
Hey, how you doing, Chris? The Sultan of Spanning Tree. I think I may be insulted by that title. We'll have to talk about that offline sometime.
Anytime I can poke fun at a networking professional, it just feels like I'm obligated to do it. Something about my background in the server world, I just have to. And you can find Ethan. He's on the Twitters @ECBanks. Joining the Datanauts today is Eric Shanks. He's a solutions architect and a blogger, really great blog called The IT Hollow, and someone I've known for many years as a colleague in the world of IT. So Eric, welcome to the show. And if you don't mind, for our listeners, please give us a rundown on what it is you do to pay the bills.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Ethan. Thanks for inviting me. As you said, I'm a senior solutions architect for a consultant in Chicago, and I help customers determine their requirements and constraints and assumptions and all those things and put designs together for them. But I also run a blog in my spare time and do all things technical.
That's a lot of things. So you consult and blog and do all things technical. How do you find the time for that?
That's a really good question. My wife would ask me the same question. It's lucky that she's great, because I don't think I make enough time for her or family, and that's what ends up suffering.
Fair enough. Well, in this show, I wanted to kind of dive into someone that I know personally that's gone through an amazing transformation. To give Eric some kudos, he's really become definitely the full stack engineer. And I thought, you know, it'd be really cool if we dedicated an episode to really sitting down and kind of going through that journey and getting his opinions, as well as I wanted to pick the brains of my co-host, because I know he's gone through a pretty awesome journey himself. Let's talk about general technical skills and how you learn and that sort of jazz. Eric, let's kick it off with, what skill silos were you most drawn to when you started in IT?
To begin with, it was servers. And I'll be honest, the reason it was servers is because I had, you know, used Windows before. So just playing games or whatever as I was growing up, you know, I'd used Windows, and I got out of college and it was time to get a job. The only thing I had a lot of experience with was operating systems. So servers is kind of where I started, but it was more out of necessity, really, than anything that I was really passionate about at the time. I was so new, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do.
Oh, fair enough. I remember starting in IT as well. It's like, well, I know this little bit, and frankly, I need to feed myself and pay off this student loan in my case. So you have to just choose whatever you know at the time and then grow it out. You mentioned Windows. It gets a lot of crap kind of in the ecosystem as being an operating system that causes both pain and pleasure. I'm more on the pleasure side myself, but a number of folks hate it. Is this skill really relevant today? Can you just be an operating system or a Windows guru, or is that decayed or regressed in some way?
Yeah, I think it really has digressed a little bit. I don't see in my day-to-day job people that are specifically working on operating systems all day long. That's the only thing they do. The job role is really changing a little bit, and they have to know something besides just the operating systems. They have to know how it interacts with the rest of the data center. And, you know, Windows versus Linux versus Mac or any of those things, that's personal preference to me most of the time. But I grew up with Windows, and now that I do a little bit more automation and things, I'm starting to lean towards Linux a little more. But, you know, Windows was the first love.
Ethan, I'm curious, you're really well known as a networking professional. You've got a lot of kudos and credentials in that space. What drew you to IT? Did you start out as a networking engineer, or was it something else?
No, I really started out as a sysadmin. So we're going back to the mid-90s. My career began dealing with Novell servers. I had graduated from college with a computer science degree, did a lot of programming in that course of study. Got out of college, didn't really find a programming job, and did some work in banking. I taught for a year and then was looking for a job in banking to further that career. And it was at a time when the industry was consolidating. I couldn't find anything despite a lot of sending out resumes and so on. And I went to Novell School and got a certification as a Novell certified netware engineer way back in the days. I'm sure some of people are going to remember that, the big red box and all of that. And I started consulting. I got a job where the training center I was at liked my performance in the classroom and said, hey, we have room for a junior engineer. You want to give it a try? And I did. That started out my road as a sysadmin. And I, you know, networking back in the days, I mean, Novell was the network. You just patched all this stuff together and, you know, you weren't configuring switches or VLANs or any of that kind of stuff. You just needed something to plumb the network together. And there were various topologies, but Ethernet was coming into its fore at that point. The switches weren't something you thought much about. They were just something you plugged the network servers and the clients into so that they could get to the network server. So a very different mindset back in the day, but that is actually how I started.
Do you have scars on your heart that say vampire taps and token ring and hubs?
So I showed up just as those solutions were fading away. I do remember some of those. I did work with a good bit of what you would call thin net, not thick net, where you would use vampire taps. It was a thin net coax with BNC connectors and 50 ohm terminators stuck on either end of the cable. And troubleshot some of those sorts of networks. But mostly what I've worked on over the years is twisted pair. If I have scars from those early days, it's from network servers abending, abnormal termination of some process that was critical to file or print or backup, whatever it was.
Fair enough. Well, I won't have to ask you if those skills are relevant anymore. Rest in peace, Novell. We loved you. Your time was over too quickly, but that's definitely in the grave.
Well, right. Netware is long gone. I mean, Novell's still around, but Netware itself is a major OS is gone. And I moved on from that to Windows and became an MCSE later on, and a lot of that still matters. I'll put it this way. A lot of the skills that I picked up there and the way of thinking haven't changed. Has the technology changed to move on? You bet. But the way of thinking, the services provided, and some of the core considerations you have as an engineer back from 20-odd years ago still are relevant.
Fair enough. Eric, I guess this question's towards you then. A lot of folks in IT get hired, you're hired to do a job. That job contains a certain number of skills that are required to do that job. In a lot of cases, it feels like there's kind of an entropy there. You don't really have to go beyond what you know. You can kind of hold the business back if you want. Those are the IT professionals that tend to drive me nuts. But there's typically not a lot of drive from the business in many cases where you have to expand well beyond your silos. You know, you can just say, oh, that's not part of my job. So in your case, what kicked you in the butt to expand beyond being the Windows guy?
So when I first started in the industry, I was working for some small companies that didn't have hardly any staff. So that they were doing everything in the data center, right? And when I say data center, I mean there was a closet that had some servers in it, right? And some switches and a router. And there were blinking lights, and I wasn't sure what some of those things did. But the problem was I don't like to not know the answer to things. So I would be able to handle the servers, but if I was having a connectivity issue between sites or between specific servers, I didn't know any of the networking to help troubleshoot that. And it bothered me. So it was one of those things where when those things happen, that you would troubleshoot them, try and get them up and running, and you might have to ask somebody initially. But then once it was over, you would kind of look at it and say, okay, now why did that really happen? What's the thing that's going on in the background that makes this work? So that kind of, you know, would push me into the next thing where I would learn a little bit of networking and, you know, oh, this is what a ping does, right? At a very basic level. And then you would learn about layer two and layer three and all these things. And it's just not knowing the answer to something drove me to learn something new, which drove me to find that there was another thing I didn't know. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that the more you know, the more you know you don't know, right?
I really identify with what you were saying, Eric. I didn't know what the answer was and it bugged me. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how I feel about things even today. I got to know how it works and what's really going on to satisfy that itch and just you want to know how it really works. Exactly.
Is that just a thirst for technical knowledge, would you say? Or is there a flavoring of I'm not comfortable being in an environment where I don't understand how it's working and perhaps in some way don't necessarily trust someone 100%. I want to see how they're putting it together so that I agree with that. Is it a little mix of both of those, do you think?
Yeah, I think it would be a little bit of a mix of both of those. And if somebody were to explain to me the reasoning behind something, I'm generally okay with that. I don't have to see it with my own eyes, as long as it makes sense. If someone explains to me a new topic, and even after they've explained it, something doesn't click, like does that something there doesn't make sense, then I got to see it, right? I have to, you know, build it on my own or do some more investigation, or maybe I don't understand some of the underlying concepts that whoever is explaining it to me already knows and assumes that I know, right? It's a little bit of that where I have some things where I'll just, okay, that makes sense to me. Let's move on. I get the concept of this, and other things where no, I have to go and see this myself.
All right, let's transition into learning mode. So you've identified some things that irritate you. You're in a job and you're like, man, I really want to know how this piece of the data center works, the network or the storage or fiber channel over Ethernet, which I don't think anyone really knows how that works. Ba-doom-tsh. So you've identified something in the data center. It's irritating you. Now you're like, all right, I need to learn this skill. I need to get acquainted in a more professional fashion with how this technology works. How do you address that? What is your go-to method for prioritizing A, the time to learn the skill, and then B, picking methods to actually start learning this technology?
Yeah, that one's always the question. So I hate to plug wallnetwork.com, but you wrote a post not too long ago about your default gateway as it relates to IT people. And the idea behind the post was basically that if you don't know the answer to something, you've got one go-to person that you go and ask first, right? And they, even if they don't know the answer, direct you someplace where you can find the answer. And that really resonated with me, and it makes a lot of sense. There's always been a couple people that if I couldn't find it on Google right away, or I had done some research and couldn't figure out what this was, I would go to that person and ask them. And they didn't always have the answers either, but they usually could direct me someplace where I could go and find out more information. And then to go on, you mentioned that eventually you become that default gateway for somebody else. And that blog post really resonated with me a lot and makes a perfect sense. And it relates to everything that we're doing, and specifically this question, what do you do when you don't know the answer? You ask somebody.
Got it. So first person on your list is typically Google. He's a good friend of mine too. But then beyond that, you've got kind of your inner circle of folks that you can ask questions of. Like you said, they may not know the answer. And I love that you had to cite my blog. I know that just destroys your day and makes mine. So
it's a little frustrating for me. But also, if you, in this case, were my default gateway and I had to ask you this question, there are also times when I would ask you a question and you would then direct me to Google again and say, you haven't looked at this enough. Go do some more investigation. It's out there.
Yeah, right? You have to keep folks humble in that they need to keep their Google foo sharpened.
It's funny you talk about going to other people. That has rarely been my approach over the years. And I don't know why that is. I mean, it's just my nature, but my source of truth has tended to be vendor manuals. Most of them are horribly written and difficult to get through. I got to say that, like someone for whom English is a distant second or third language wrote it, and then it was translated into English. And it's so bad to get your head around some of these manuals. But at the same time, what I find is going through official vendor docs, if I'm trying to learn something, show me the way the vendor intended for you to get something done and how it is supposed to work, one, and then two, a whole bunch of capabilities and features that I didn't even know I was looking for. And so that'll really open my mind up to what the technology is that's here and what it's capable of. That isn't to say I don't go to other people and I don't have sharp Google foo. I definitely do. And that's something that, because I'm old and 20 years ago, all we had were the manuals, you know, then maybe that's just the habit I got into. Certainly things have gotten better today with great blog sites and so on that are better with the community sharing and quality information coming out.
And I would agree with you on the manual thing a little bit, but it's been my experience that many times I'll go to the manual and it's not laid out in a well-defined way. Like they'll give you information about how things were supposed to work. But if you read on a blog or somebody else's site who's actually done it, they'll tell you what those caveats are. And they're like, well, it's supposed to work this way, but in reality, it doesn't. It works in a different way. And that's more useful to me.
And I have to admit, my experience with manuals has been hit or miss. I found some incredibly good ones and some pretty bloody awful ones at the same time.
That sounds like a mix may be preferable, you know, especially as y'all were answering the question, I thought about how difficult and kind of walled garden traditional vendor documents were. You know, you had to have a support account, had to be an active contract, you have to sign into some various walled off site. It was like digging for buried treasure. But once you got it, you might be able to find a good white paper or some good configuration documentation. And you're right, Ethan, it would outline every single command you could possibly ever want and just give you kind of all the nuts and bolts and checkboxes for the product. At the same time, talking to someone who's been through it or reading their blog or whatever it may be, sure, it's not an authoritative source per se. It's kind of their way of setting something up. But a lot of times they can tell you those horror stories and save you so much drama and so much pain when they say, all right, when you're going through this particular process, don't do step 7 because it causes everything to explode. And I've run into a number of situations where someone has really saved my bacon because they've been through the trenches and they know exactly how to cause a system to fail. So I think both can be valuable.
during the break, we wanted to look back at some of the comments you folks that listen to the Data Knots podcast have shared with you. We're getting a lot of love and we really appreciate it. For example, David Pasek says, I'm a Packet Pushers listener from several years ago and there's always been great content. However, the Data Knots shows are my favorites now, probably because I'm a virtualization guy trying to understand networking as much as possible. Thank you, Chris and Ethan, so much for your efforts and good luck in 2016. Hey, thanks a lot, David, and we hope to do exactly that. We got a lot of shows we're planning, a lot. Should be a good year.
Absolutely. That's definitely the point. We got another feedback from Damon, says that this is his favorite podcast to listen to now. Great job, guys. And I'm looking forward to learning more from your upcoming shows. And again, we really appreciate the feedback. And it's like juice for the brain, you know, energy for the soul to hear that there's people being impacted by the show. And it really drives us to want to make as many shows as we possibly can.
Prashant adds, good podcast, one of the few that really breaks down complex stuff in an easy to understand manner, although a lot of it still goes over my head. Hey, Prashant, we'll do better. We're not trying to have content go over anybody's head. We definitely want everyone to be able to get a hold of it and understand it. So glad you're listening and getting a lot out of it.
I've got one more here. It looks like Bodhi says, I'm enjoying listening to your podcasts on the way to work every day. Rock on. Just be careful when you're driving, 10 and 2 for your hands. And he's in the UK, so I've driven over there and I didn't crash in anything. I felt really good about that. He says he really loved the recent Home Labs show and the introduction of the Docker podcast. So definitely thumbs up, and we really appreciate that. The Docker episode was one of my favorites too. I had a lot of fun recording that one. So it's really great to hear that some of these shows are specifically resonating with our audience.
Another way that I've learned a lot beyond just reading and talking to other people and so on has been certifications. I've done tons of certifications over the years, Mr. Wall, and also had some great mentorship experiences, either where someone was explaining to me because they came down from the ivory tower and said, son, let me show you how this works. You know, I had some really, really, truly great moments like that. And I then had the chance to mentor other people myself. So maybe we should talk about that.
I think that's a great idea. Let's start with mentorship first, just because kind of near and dear to my heart. I'll put the question back to you, Ethan. First off, do you mentor others? And if you do, what practices do you personally feel worked well or just totally fell flat on its face?
So mentorship, I mean, it has almost a formal connotation, the word, but the way I look at mentorship is you're working with other people. You want to share your knowledge with them in a way that is not arrogant, that is not off-putting. Or, hey, stupid, this is how this works. You don't want to take that approach. But if you take the approach of, I learned how this works, and this is how I think about this, you got a few minutes, I'm happy to show you what I figured out. And then, you know, people are happy with that approach, and you can teach in that way. These are the things that I've picked up about how the thus and so works. A switch or a router or a firewall, if it's me who's been doing a lot of network engineering in the last 15 years or so. You know, or other stuff. And yeah, I think it's really important. I am not interested in keeping all the knowledge inside my head. I want other people to know how to do the things that I know how to do because it means I'm no longer a spoff in the operational process.
I think that's key. Absolutely. Eric, are you mentoring anyone either formally or informally? And what's working and what seems to not be working?
I find mentoring a difficult topic to talk about, mainly because I don't wake up in the morning and go, you know what, I'm going to go mentor somebody today, you know, or you know what I want to be? I want to be a mentor. It doesn't end up working out that way. But there are other people that I work with on a daily basis that have questions or don't understand things. And I already know that information. I want to be their default gateway, right? And help them get the information that they need so that they can move on with whatever they're working on. Or, you know, it could be something that somebody set a goal for themselves to get some sort of a certification and they want to do this and maybe they don't have the confidence to do it, or maybe they're stuck in a certain section or whatever. And all you need to do is check in with them and say, you know, how's it going? Are you having any issues with any of these things? Is there any way I can help? And maybe them explain to me what they're trying to do ends up helping them. They figured it out as they explain it, right?
Yes, yes. I think you hit it right on the head there. Too often, I feel like mentorship is purely put in the bucket of technical. I'm going to tell you or instruct you how to make things happen. And when you brought up the idea of building confidence, providing positivity, really helping someone that's going through a journey that you've been through make that transition, that's probably one of the most valuable things a mentor can do. I saw a tweet recently that said something to the degree of, it takes so little effort to prop someone up that just a word here or there can really make someone's day, and the lack thereof can really hurt their day. You know, we tend to mistake someone not saying something with almost being negative. So being someone's positivity in their journey, being someone that can say, hey, what are you doing? How is it going? Is there anything I can help with? You know, kind of cheerlead them on is pretty huge. I've had folks that did that for me, and it was very positive, and it helps recharge your batteries a little bit.
I'll also say the opposite. Sometimes it depends on the person completely. You know, some people need a little bit of extra confidence or know that somebody's there with them. But in many cases, especially with myself, there's been times when someone said to me, you know, you suck. And that doesn't resonate well with me. And it makes me go, okay, I'm going to show you and I'm going to get this and I'm going to figure out how this works. And you're not going to be able to say you suck anymore. So it depends on the person.
So potentially negative reinforcement may or may not work. I don't know if I would suggest negative reinforcement. But yeah, certainly if you're in a group of colleagues and you know each other really well, and there's a certain bit of fun that you can poke against each other about who needs to up their game, we'll say, that can make kind of a spirit of competition.
For sure. You have to, you really have to know the person before you can go down that route. If somebody you don't know, you just meet them and you're like, oh, you suck at this. That's probably not the best route.
Fair enough. So it sounds like mentorship could be a formal thing, but in a lot of cases, it's just finding your kind of inner circle of colleagues and professionals, either in real life, people that you work with or are nearby, or just on the internet and coaching them and helping them go along. What about the other way around? Do you advise IT professionals to find a mentor? What do you like or hate about that? And how do you find and validate a mentor? How do you identify somebody that would make a good mentor?
Advise finding an IT professional as a mentor? Absolutely. There's going to be a certain point in time where you're going to go and you're working on issues and you've checked out Google, you've checked out manuals, you don't understand how anything works, or you're trying to achieve some sort of goal that somebody else has already done. Absolutely go find a mentor. But it's one of those things that's tough to go out and seek a mentor. You have to run into them, right? It's got to be somebody that you've had conversations with, or somebody that they have to really be in your inner circle to really consider them as a mentor. I can't just pick up any guy off the street. I have to have some sort of relationship with them prior. And if they're already in your inner circle somehow, you've kind of validated them already.
Ethan, what do you think?
I agree with what Eric's saying, but I think there's a practical side of this that I've had a challenge with over the years, which is finding a mentor is really hard. If you want someone that's going to explain to you this or that, or spend some quality time with you so you understand design principles, let's say, data center design, it's hard to find those people. And if you can find those people, they're busy. They may not want to, or may not just simply have the time to mentor you. So I think there's a challenge there that you've got to be realistic about. And you can't pity yourself. Oh, I couldn't find a mentor. I'm just going to suck forever. You do have to take control on your own and move the ball ahead, which maybe that's a segue into the next part of our conversation, Chris, which is about certifications.
Absolutely. So I want to put a pin in that for just a moment. Let's talk about, Eric, the fact that you started out as this Windows operating system focused guy. How has your career changed? Where are you at now? I know you're doing a lot with vRealize automation because I see your blog post, but describe from a full stack engineering perspective, what tools are in your tool belt within the stack?
Yeah, I started off as a server operating system kind of guy because, you know, that's where I had a little bit of background and latched onto that. And that's where I started. So I got my MCSE in server 2003, I think. And once I got my MCSE done, I said, well, okay, you know, what's next? And networking was one of those things that I had very little experience with. So I picked up a CCNA route and switch book and started reading through it, and can't tell you how many things I learned just by reading the book, studying for the exam.
So you were using certifications as a stepping stone to grow your stack of skills, per se.
I was, and I've heard lots of people explain that studying for the test is just studying for the test. It doesn't give you any of that real world knowledge that you need to have. In several circumstances, like CCNA was one of them, I didn't know anything about the subject. I picked up the book mainly with the end goal being, okay, let me see if I can get a CCNA certification. But reading the books, I learned so much about networking that I was able to do it in my day-to-day job. And just doing some of that in my day-to-day job, just it made me get my CCNA much quicker because I was actually doing it now.
No, absolutely. You can't just step into a lot of these jobs, being a network engineer as an example, with zero information. Or if you do, it's going to be a lot of rework, I feel like, later, a lot of technical debt put into the system later. And you're saying the certification process forced you to read and learn the fundamentals of networking as this particular skill is brought up so that you could then start applying them in real world. I'm not saying that you couldn't find a mentor or somebody to like walk you through it and completely skip the cert, but it feels like the certification points you to a resource to actually start gaining the skills that you might have missed if you didn't do it as an undergrad in college, as an example.
Yeah, exactly. And in my case, I was working for a small enough company that we weren't doing a whole lot of major network changes to the infrastructure. So the idea of me learning Spanning Tree just through the day-to-day work was not going to happen because I wasn't adding switches very often at all. But reading about it, like, oh, I get how this works now. So if I ever have to add a switch to something at work, I got to do this so I don't have a loop, you know.
You're also a VMware certified design expert, which is VMware's highest certification. How do you go from MCSE and CCNA all the way to the VCDX, as it's known for its initialism? What was kind of the meat in between? Because I know you're doing work with, it sounds like, automation and private cloud. And it feels like a pretty big leap to go from networking and servers all the way to private cloud and automation with cloud management platform.
I was doing work for another customer when virtualization got introduced to us through a consultant. And once I saw virtualization and all the power that they had behind that, that's when I really got passionate about IT. You know, I liked doing my job before, but once I saw virtualization, I was like, this is what I want to do. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do more virtualization was because virtualization seemed to touch storage, networking, compute. It touched everything. So I got a little bit of everything there, and there were so many things I could learn. And I liked the idea of a full stack engineer before I ever heard the term full stack engineer, right? So virtualization is where I really fell in love and got my VCP. I eventually got my VCAP because I wanted to be better at vSphere stuff.
Just real quick, the VCP is the VMware Certified Professional, which at the time it was the entry level VMware cert. Now it's the associate level is the entry level. And the VCAP or the VCAP is the advanced professional, which is kind of the next tier up, which VCA, VCP, VCAP, and VCDX are the four levels of certification for VMware.
Yeah, so I got my VCAP and thought, you know, this is good. I've got a very deep understanding of vSphere and the technologies behind it. I should be able to do my job at this point. I then started working for a partner as a consultant. And at that point, I thought, when I went into work for the consultant, I decided maybe VCDX is in my future. And it was kind of one of those things. It's Mount Everest. It was to me when I started it, right? It was one of those things where I didn't think I actually had the skills to do it. I didn't think that I was capable of completing it, but I was going to give it a shot and find out. And that was one of those certifications where it wasn't about me learning anything new. It was more about me proving to myself that I was able to do this. And that's why I decided to try it.
So Eric, when you started talking about certs, you mentioned some people who, well, a certification, all it teaches you is how to pass the exam. It doesn't really teach you any real world skills. And I'm with you in disagreeing with that position. So I have used certifications over the years to learn how the vendor expects me to use their product and what the capabilities are. And there is an aspect of, yeah, you're learning to pass an exam and get a cert. I get that. But at the same time, you are getting all of these actual key skills that are required to operate that vendor's product in the way that that vendor intends. That doesn't mean that that real life might deviate from that. In fact, it probably is going to. But once you've been exposed to everything that's in the certification program, in many cases, I've done lots and lots of certs over the years. I mean, I talked about Novell and Microsoft stuff back in the day, but I've also done tons of Cisco certs along the way as well. And man, when you get into those certs, you find out what you didn't know. I mean, you get exposed to things like, I didn't even know that was a thing. Wow. And you start learning whatever it is that you didn't know and begin thinking about how that technology you were previously unfamiliar with can benefit the environment you're working on. And it's very powerful and it makes you a much stronger engineer. It broadens your perspective. It makes you think about things in a way that you didn't before. It makes you aware of problems that maybe you didn't know were even potential problems in your environment because it had never broken before, even though it was just something sitting there waiting to break, and really gets you out in front of what your environment could be if you maximize what the technical capabilities are. Certifications help get you there very much. I would say there's value in diligently going through a certification program, even if you don't care about the cert particularly and you don't have plans to go through the exam. If you diligently master that material that's presented to you, you're going to learn a lot. I think there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, to me, I've equated it to having some home improvement project, and I could just take whatever tools I have locally, my little toolbox of stuff, and try to work through it. Or the certification blueprint to me is like the hardware store. I can go to Home Depot and I can see the aisles and aisles of all the different tools and all the different ways that you could solve this problem. Kind of like looking at the blueprint tells you, here's the 95 bajillion things that we expect you to know for our products. And like you said, Ethan, a lot of them I've probably never been exposed to. Like when I was going through the UCS certifications, things like VMFex, I had never used that. I didn't know what that was. I've never seen it used in the wild. So just learning about it told me, oh, there's another way I can solve this problem. Maybe I'm not going to use it, but at least I'm aware of it. And then I feel like if your technical team or your business says, hey, we want to solve X problem, you can say, okay, here's the three options. Here's why I don't like this one. I do like this one. You're much more knowledgeable and relevant in the conversation, I feel. We've talked about skills and certs and mentoring and where did you start? How did you get to where you're at now? And I wanted to provide in this kind of piece of the podcast some information to folks who are going through the journey. You know, let's be virtual mentors to all of the snazzy Data Knots listeners because we love you all so much. And so I want to talk about the resources that you should be looking at as a technical professional and the next steps. Where should you be going? What should you be doing from folks that have been through the trenches and have practical real world experience with it? Eric, let's start with you. In the world of IT right now, you're in the meat of it, right? You're working with customers that are solving some pretty complex challenges in, you know, SME all the way through large enterprise. So what are the skills that you feel are really heavily valued right now? And if I'm a technical professional that's looking to become more of a full stack across multiple skill silos, what's worth pursuing with vigor? What should I be attacking as a skill?
For me, the thing that we're doing the most work in and the thing that I'm trying to learn more about every single day is scripting and automation. I'm seeing this trend to shift that everything needs to be automated and built very, 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 very quickly. It's no longer okay to deploy a virtual machine from a template and say, look how fast we built that server. It's become more than that. And it needs to be, look how fast we built this app, or look how fast we deployed this app into our existing environment in the load balancer. And to do that, you have to have some sort of scripting experience. But it's not necessarily all about the scripting. You have to have a bunch of underlying technologies under your belt before you can start that. So you can't just go in and say, oh, I'm going to script this to go out and build my server and deploy my app and update change management systems and all that stuff. I'm going to do all that. You have to have an understanding of how all those things kind of work in the background. Even if you're not an expert in any one of those things, you have to have some sort of background in all of those pieces. So I'll admit it, it's very challenging because you have to kind of be the guy who knows everything, and it's just not feasible, right?
Hence the part of the full stack and full stack engineer. You'd have to know, all right, how do I get the load balancer to talk to the network, to talk to my IP address management, to then put in, you know, in my CMDB and then provision a server. It's a long Rube Goldbergian machine that you have to set up to automate and then orchestrate all those automation tasks, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'll just echo, Eric, what you were saying about automation. It's true in networking as well, where I spend most of my time. Automation's a hot topic. Networking as an industry is so far behind where much of the rest of the industry is as far as the ability to automate cleanly and predictably and so on. I actually wrote about this in my newsletter that we don't have standard APIs in networking. We don't have structured data that's coming back for scripts and, you know, and these sorts of things. So yes, there is Python and NetMiko, you know, a show I recorded for the Packet Pushers Weekly, discussing in some detail how you do scripting with those tools. And at the end of the day, it comes down to CLI and screen scraping, unfortunately, how it's actually working in the background. That said, the need for network automation to join up with the rest of the data center. Hey guys, we're trying to deploy an application here, exactly as you said, Eric, and networking might be a part of that. Great, we need to automate it. How are we going to do it? Picking up scripting and getting into automating of the network provisioning piece is becoming a key skill to have. And many of us have legacy networks that aren't good with, you know, APIs. They just don't have any. And so therefore, getting a handle on what tools can handle that sort of an environment is key. Looking forward, it will be APIs, I believe, and interacting with APIs, you know, putting data in and getting data back out of them, which is a bit different from screen scraping for sure and better. And software-defined networking may take us to a place where instead of individually configuring devices, you know, one at a time, we're configuring the network as a whole. And we're doing that because it's part of the larger IT data center system that is delivering applications. Getting our brains wrapped around how that works is another critical skill. And many people are just stuck in the past. They don't want to move beyond, you know, spanning tree as has come up a few times on this show.
Yeah, with you being the sultan of spanning tree, I can see why you would bring that up. So what I'm hearing is automation sort of depends on what your vertical is from a skill perspective. You know, if in networking world, it's a little more Wild West, and the server and kind of private cloud world, it's a little more advanced, but it still feels very infantile to me. I feel like we're really taking our first steps into these fully automated data centers. Would it be fair to say then that you can kind of start with learning how to talk to APIs and what the logic is to scripting, and then pick a small subset of technologies to automate, per se, to talk to in an automated fashion, and then grow that out? Eric, is that feasible?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you automate what you can automate, and the things that you can't automate, you just have to figure out how you can fit it into your existing process, right? So if you're deploying new apps and you're going to make a shift to a cloud-based architecture, then you're left with, you know, I've got some legacy gear that I've still got to deal with, but I've got all these new things as well. Let's program the things we can program or script the things we can script. And then let's see how we can get those to work with the existing infrastructure. And maybe you're making decisions for 3 to 5 years down the road on, you know, how you're going to change your infrastructure to fit with your goal of a cloud architecture.
Sure. Well, what about recommending that, I guess, more operations centric folks, you know, the historically like the server and storage folks, learn how to interact with code repositories, how to do pull requests and work with GitHub? Is that something that is just critical as a full stack engineer? Is it a nice to have? You know, where does that sit in your kind of field of vision?
I don't think it's critical at the moment, but if you want to continue a career in IT, I think it would really behoove you to learn how version control works and changing your infrastructure over to code. It seems like that's the direction that things are happening. And there's a certain amount of knowledge that you may have if you're, you know, the server guy, right? And you've dealt with servers your entire life. You know them inside and out. That knowledge can't really be replaced. But the trend is to go to more of an automated fashion. And you should learn some of the new skills as well so that if things change in the future, you can still be a part of the IT infrastructure. And you're not trying to find that one job that still needs a server engineer that's all you're going to do.
To me, things like Git as a distributed version control system or whatever you want to use, I just use Git as an example, is really the language where we start getting to crossover between operations and development. It's kind of that singularity moment where the Venn diagram overlaps with one another and we have some common ground where I can push configuration management into various projects and whatnot so that the developers can then look at what's going on and then also send their data back to me. So I'm a pretty huge proponent for version control systems. I think it's a way that you can really start to learn the other side of the fence as it is within IT. Ethan, are you using something like that in the network world? Is it all that important over there?
I mean, Git is Git, right? If you want to use version control, it seems to be the default standard. And so there are definitely folks in the networking world that are using Git for vendors and open source projects related to networking that are putting their code out there for people to use. Git is the standard way to deal with it. So I've fiddled with it some at the command line. I've pushed code up and just enough to get familiar with it. I'm very far from proficient with it. I'm definitely a noob, but I've spent enough time to get a handle on the fundamentals of how it works. It does seem to be the thing that if you just have no idea how to interact with Git, you're going to get left behind.
Absolutely. If someone says to go pull code from a repo, you shouldn't be afraid of that. I think you should be able to know how to download the source files or the zip and work with those files for sure. The last thing I want to tickle is kind of, I want to be a little aggressive with this. I want to poke fun of conferences a little bit and see if they still hold value. Eric, do you go to conferences? If you do, is it about the professional networking, learning new skills, you know, you gaining exposure to next gen tech, something else? Because it feels like a lot of the meat to these conferences, especially the vendor conferences, has started to evaporate. It feels more like just kind of a social event, whereas before it was really the place where you're learning the new stuff and you can get exposure to what's coming down the pipeline, that kind of jazz.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, you're right. I still go to conferences. I don't go to very many anymore. I go to one at least every year. And I think that I get less out of that conference anymore, but part of me wonders if maybe I'm getting less out of it because I know more stuff about that particular product, right? Mm, okay. So, you know, maybe I'm not getting as much out of this anymore, but that doesn't mean that other people aren't still learning tons of things when they go to this conference, right? And I still do find value, and I learn about the new technology and the changes that are happening with the companies. And most of it is that I go there and I get the social networking, right? Where I'm getting in touch with people that I have only seen over, you know, like the Twitters or phone calls or Skype or things like that. And just touching base with them once a year is very valuable to me, because I don't know how many times I've gone and asked a question online to somebody that I had one conversation with at a conference, and they're more than happy to help out with it or whatever. So I think they're valuable. But as far as the specific technologies that they're talking about or the training that's provided there, to me personally, maybe not quite as valuable as they were maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Right. So you're saying you've gained quite a bit of knowledge on the particular topics that are covered at the conferences, that you're kind of looking for those little gold nuggets rather than carte blanche. Everything there is kind of new and bewildering.
Right. My mind's not really blown when I go to the conference anymore. But, you know, I do still learn new things. It's just that when I'm done with the conference, I don't feel overloaded with all, oh my God, I have to learn all these things.
Conferences are getting harder to attend. It's expensive. It's travel. It's time out of the office. It's difficult to get them funded for those reasons. And the value is, yeah, it really depends on the show. InterOp I've been involved with as a speaker or an organizer for the last several years now. And so I'm kind of biased towards InterOp. You know, I've been working with a group of people at InterOp who are really trying to make it valuable for the practitioner. So people that actually do IT for a living, what's some content that's good for those folks? And InterOp covers everything, virtualization, cloud, networking, and so on. And so there's been a real effort there on the part of those folks to make that conference valuable. Like I said, I'm biased. I work with that conference, so fair enough. Cisco Live historically has been one where if you're ready to drink from the technical fire hose, go to Cisco Live. It's going to fill your brain up. And they bring in all the heavy engineers from the reseller community and from Cisco themselves to just kill you with technical content. But then they publish that content, for the most part, freely available. You can get all the presentations and in many cases, a video of the presentation. So if you don't make it to Cisco Live, you can still get the tech out of it. So do you have to go to wherever Cisco Live is being held this year? Yeah, you know, not necessarily. Eric, I definitely wanted to echo your sentiment that the social aspect of it is a pretty big deal. It's kind of nice to be able to talk to other people who are working on IT challenges and brainstorm on how to solve those issues or how they did solve them, what choices they made and why did they make that choice, and so on. And then like you make connections that last after the conference. So you get to talk to folks at the show, and then you've got an email address or a business card they leave you with, and then you can communicate with them afterwards and maintain a valuable and enriching relationship that goes beyond. So there is some use to conferences, but it's I don't go to a lot of them. Let's put it that way.
That's a good point, Ethan. I mean, that's where DataNauts came from. We met at Cisco Live 2013, I believe. Had some lunch and kind of said, hey, hello. I was like, hello, and realized we were not space aliens and had some ideas. So there is a good social aspect to it for sure.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've met somebody at a conference and didn't realize what kind of an impact that would have later on, doing tech field days and things like that. Just getting stuck and thinking about how many different personal default gateways I just met at a conference. And then I can ask them questions on Twitter or, you know, be their default gateway, you know, in that respect.
All right. So it sounds like takeaway there, conferences still have some meat on the bone, mostly in connections, right? Professional networking, finding people that can be your person to talk to ask questions, to kind of pick the brain of, or just to say, hey, thanks for answering all of my silly questions. I appreciate that, and do a high five or something like that. So with that, we're going to wrap. Eric, appreciate you being on the show. Plug where you're at on the internets, you know, Twitter and social media and all that kind of jazz.
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is @Eric_Shanks. And you can find my blog. It's called theithollow.com. And I live in the Chicago area, so stop by a VMUG event and I'll be around.
Great, great. Thank you very much for joining the show. And thank you for listening to the show. We're really impressed with the amount of feedback that we're getting. And if you're in that journey, you're going through the quote unquote full stack engineering journey, you're working on broaching different topics in the data center, you're trying to get more DevOpsian, trying to become a server/storage/network person, whatever it may be, reach out to us. You can reach out to datanauts@wallnetwork.com, or there's a contact page on the Packet Pushers website that you can use to talk to them directly or tweet at me or whatever it is. I'm available a bajillion different ways. that's it for today's show of the Data Nauts podcast. You can reach Ethan. He's at EC Banks on the Twitters, and his blog is ethancbanks.com. And myself, I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitters, or my blog is wallnetwork.com. For more superb Data Nauts content, it's all free. It's all delicious. It tastes like candy. Just do the crab walk on over to packetpushers.net and partake on that bountiful feast of that delicious podcast goodness. Until then, I hope that your server lights continue to blink, your storage spindles continue to spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. We could do a...
You know, the thing I said about the blah blah was pretty awesome, I gotta admit.
That is very much like you, though.